Oh, good. Yeah, I did Kurt.
You can spread it around.
It appears we have a quorum. We'd like to begin on time today. We have a lot of things to talk about, a lot of people here to not only visit and present, but also to listen. So, so we'll note the roll. I was just in a committee where they actually took roll call, and I suppose that's something we could do, but it takes time, so we will not do that. To begin, let's just have a motion to approve the minutes from our last meeting. Okay, Representative Dittner, any corrections or comments? If not, all those in favor?
Aye.
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 And the minutes are approved. Today we have Minskew, Minnesota State University, with us, and we would like to begin by, I guess the board chair is going to be the first presenter, or Chancellor McCormick?
Yes.
Okay, you can begin.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being
chair
here
Norris
today.
And the committee members. And for the record, my name is Jim McCormick, and I have the privilege of serving as the Chancellor of the Minnesota State College Universities. Wonderful to see many of you that we've worked with over the years, and to welcome new members to this important committee, and to greet the staff on the first session. My suspicion is we'll have a number of meetings together before the year's over, but thank you. With me today is Scott Thiss, who's the chairman of our Board of Trustees, and Edna Szymanski to my left, who's the president of Minnesota State University Moorhead, and Kevin Kopischke, the president of Alexandria Technical and Community College. And by the way, they are not only really good presidents, but they've been elected by the other presidents to sort of be my co-leader with the Leadership Council, so they're the right ones, the ones to be here. We have several trustees and presidents in the audience, and I want to be sure that I recognize them. Trustee Cheryl Dixon, I think, is here, and Trustee Christopher Frederick, and Trustee Louise Sundin, and Trustee James Van Houten, and I think Don Larson of the IFO, I believe, is here, Don, and Jeff, are you here from... Jeff, student leader. Yes, well, welcome. And from the presidential side, from Pine Tech, is Robert Musgrove. And welcome. And by the way, we recognize the bargaining units, and because 96% of our employees are under collective bargaining agreements. So, Don, thank you for representing that group today. And at this point, I believe, Mr. Chair, we've been asked to present an overview of the state college and universities and the vital role it plays as one of the critical economic engines for the state. And Chair Thiss will begin by giving you some key facts about the system. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you, Chancellor. I'm pleased to be here today on behalf of the Board of Trustees of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. We know that Minnesota and higher education is, in general, facing some very tough times. A key question that you face as legislators is how will Minnesota best prepare for a return to economic prosperity? The Minnesota State Colleges and University system plays an important role in answering that question. Our campuses are located throughout the state. Each year we produce over almost 35,000 graduates. 80% of them stay in Minnesota to work or continue their education. They provide a real return on the state's investment. We also provide customized training and other job-related education to almost 122,000 students. The system has 7 state universities that offer bachelor's and advanced degrees, 5 technical colleges with programs leading to employment, 5 community colleges that offer arts and sciences programs for transfer to four-year institutions and occupational programs, 15 combined community and technical colleges with transfer programs and technical programs that prepare students for direct entry to careers. We have 54 campuses in 47 communities and are responsible for nearly 27 million square feet of buildings, which amounts to about one-third of the state's real estate. Chancellor McCormick will now tell you a little bit more about our students.
Thank you. I know that some of you that have been involved for a long time know most of this, but we want to present it again, new members, and a refresher for those who have been here. We're the single largest provider of higher education in Minnesota, educating 63% of all of Minnesota's undergraduates. Each year, we educate more than 433,000 students in credit and non-credit courses. Our colleges and universities offer more than 3,900 programs. They range from short-term programs that can be completed in 2 years or less to bachelor's degree and advanced degree programs. Many of our students in this system do not fit the profile of a traditional college student who is enrolled full-time and lives on campus. The average age of our students is nearly 26. Women make up 55% of our student body. Many of our students attend classes part-time because they must work to pay tuition, or in many cases, to support their families. Though we have many academically talented students, we also serve nearly all of the post-secondary students who are least prepared for college. The mission of the two-year college is open access, and that means that anyone with a high school diploma or a GED can enroll in our institutions. Many of the least prepared students are young people who are a year or two out of high school, or working adults who may have forgotten their high school algebra or maybe never took it in the first place. In other words, we serve the hardest to serve students who often have to overcome significant barriers to complete their programs. We always worry about the ability of our students to pay for their education. That is why the Board of Trustees has done its best to keep tuition in check. From 2006 to 2011, tuition and fees have gone up an average of 4.5% each year. We have had record enrollments for each of the last 5 years. This slide shows the growth in full-time equivalent enrollment. Since 2006, we have had an 18% increase. More young people are graduating from high school and realizing that they need post-secondary education. More adults are upgrading their skills and knowledge because they have been laid off or want to change careers. In either case, they want good jobs and to be able to earn a good living.
Chancellor McCormick, we have a question, I believe, at this time. Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chancellor McCormick. You briefly touched on the causes to the rise in enrollment in the Minsky system, and you may not have the information at hand, so my question would be if you would provide to the committee a greater breakdown of what the enrollment pressures are coming from. For example, you mentioned people who've lost their jobs and are seeking job retraining. If we could get a greater sense of how that breaks down so we know how to plan for budgeting purposes, to be blunt, concerning job retraining, concerning maybe underrepresented or first-generation students attending your institution, where the enrollment pressures are coming from, that'd be very helpful.
Representative Morrow will prepare that and send it to the chair.
Chancellor McCormick, resume.
Okay, thank you. Now, just as Minnesota's population is changing, as you would expect, the demographic profile of our students is shifting. Students from groups traditionally underrepresented in higher education, students of color, first-generation college students, and low-income students now make up 71% of the student body. Now, you realize that's self-reporting. Students self-report that. During the last 5 years, we've had a 31% increase in the number of underrepresented students, bringing the current total to more than 130,000 students. Now, these students are the state's current and future workforce. Students of color now make up 18% of the student body, up from 14% 5 years ago. Now, the demand for online learning is increasing. We have some 400 programs and 10,000 course sections online. Since 2005, we have quadrupled our online enrollment. At the current rate of growth, the system is on track to reach its 2015 goal of having 25% of the system full-year equivalent enrollment in online and blended online courses. We expect to reach 18% and be over 100,000 online students this year. Now, the graduates contribute, and I think this is something we just need to think about. Our graduates, universities and the colleges, contribute to the vitality of communities across the state in many ways. And every year, the college and university system educate 83% of the nursing graduates, 49% of the state's new teacher graduates, 85% of the state's law enforcement officers, 38% of the new business graduates, and we train 9,000 firefighters and first responders. Clearly, this investment in this higher education system makes it possible for us to educate Minnesota and to make it work. Now, over the years, we have consolidated and merged campuses. As a result, we went from 45 presidents to 32 presidents. We're continuing our work on this. Now I'm going to turn the presentation over to President Kopischke and President Szymanski to tell you about how the systems, colleges, and universities help build Minnesota's economy, and we'll begin with President Kopischke.
Thank you, Chancellor.
I just want to begin by welcoming both of you. You've traveled a great distance on a not-so-nice day.
It's great to be here.
You flew, right?
Right. So thank you.
Hopefully you get home safe.
We will. So. We'd like to give you a very brief introduction to our colleges and universities. Each contributes to the strategic goal to increase access, opportunity, and success, and each plays a critical role in building those regional economies that in turn contribute to Minnesota's economic health and vitality and continues to drive this great state that we live in and do business in. In our quick introduction, we'll identify the president. We will look at last year's unduplicated headcount and in credit-based courses, and we'll identify one distinguishing feature of each college or university. And let me begin with the college I serve, Alexandria Technical College. And if you'd like to follow through, and this is going to be a whirlwind tour, on the right-hand side of your white packet, the Go Places magazine is there. And beginning on page 16, I'll start with Alexandria Technical and Community College. At ATCC, we recently signed an agreement with Rockwell Automation, the world's largest industrial automation company, to expand worker training in west central Minnesota and throughout the United States. Anoka Ramsey Community College, with campuses in Cambridge and Coon Rapids, serves 11,000 students, and their interim president is Jesse Stump. Anoka Ramsey's work in the biomedical technical field has earned them a number of federal grants for curriculum development and programming to support their partnerships with industry. Sherry Olson is the interim president at Anoka Technical College in Anoka, where they serve about 3,400 students. Minnesota Workforce Centers refer many clients to Anoka Tech's Certified Medical Assistant Program for training to work with electronic medical record systems, which is a high-demand skill in that area at this time. Central Lakes College, led by President Larry Lundblad, with campuses in Brainerd and Staples, serves approximately 5,500 students. And Central Lakes is known as a leader in technology. It was rated one of the nation's top 8 digital colleges, according to the Center for Digital Education. Century College in White Bear Lake, Larry Letecki is the president, serves 13,000-plus students. And Century is one of our largest and fastest-growing colleges. A unique offering at Century is its Fab Lab, where students use fabrication tools and software to build just about anything. Dakota County Technical College in Rosemont, led by Ron Thomas, serves approximately 5,300 students. And you may know that DCTC is a nationwide leader in the field of nanotechnology. In fact, the National Science Foundation awarded Dakota Tech a $3 million grant to develop the Midwest Regional Center for Nanotechnology Education. Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College in Cloquet, led by Larry Anderson, serves approximately 2,700 students. Fond du Lac is the only tribal and community college in our system. It provides higher education opportunities for its communities, focusing on the language, culture, and history of the Anishinaabe tribal. Hennepin Technical College, with campuses in Brooklyn Park and Eden Prairie, led by Cecilia Cervantes, serves approximately 8,600 students. And Hennepin Tech works with more than 300 industry advisory members to ensure that their curriculum meets the needs of industry. Inver Hills Community College in Inver Grove Heights, led by Tim Wines, serves 8,500 students. And Inver Hills serves as a regional training center for Cisco Academy instructor courses that teach students how to design, build, troubleshoot, and secure computer networks. Lake Superior College in Duluth, led by Pat Johns, serves approximately 8,500 students. And Lake Superior's Emergency Response Training Center provides world-class training for emergency response professionals, including firefighters and EMTs. Minneapolis Community and Technical College in Minneapolis, led by Phil Davis, serves almost 13,500 students. And MCTC offers a number of unique programs, including air traffic control, apparel technologies, biotechnology, computer forensics, and homeland security, just to name a few. Minnesota State College Southeast Tech in Red Wing and Winona, led by Jim Johnson, serves approximately 3,000 students. And students are trained as technicians in the fast-growing emerging field of geothermal technology at Southeast Technical. Minnesota State Community and Technical College, with campuses in Detroit Lakes, Fergus Falls, Moorhead, and Wadena, serves almost 9,000 students and is led by Ann Valentine. And we are excited to announce that Fergus Falls is indeed celebrating its 50th anniversary this year and recently introduced a one-year diploma program in equine science. Minnesota West Community and Technical College, with campuses in Canby, Granite Falls, Jackson, Pipestone, and Worthington, serves approximately 4,500 students, President Richard Shrub. And Minnesota West is the first campus in the system to erect an on-campus wind tower used for both learning and power generation. Normandale Community College in Bloomington, led by Joe Opatz, serves approximately 14,000 students. And Normandale is one of only four community colleges across the country that is now accredited in three fine arts areas: theater, music, and art. North Hennepin Community College in Brooklyn Park, led by John O'Brien, serves nearly 10,000 students. And veterans attending North Hennepin can find assistance for navigating the challenge array of federal, state, and local veterans programs at an on-campus Veterans Resource Center. Veteran Resource Centers are available at most of our colleges and universities throughout the system. The Northeast Higher Education District, with campuses in Hibbing, Grand Rapids, Ely, Eveleth, Virginia, and International Falls, serve nearly 7,000 students, and Northeast Higher Ed is led by Sue Collins. This consortium of five colleges supports the area's economic vitality, particularly with specialty programs in natural resources, industrial mechanical technology, green and sustainable construction technology, wildland, wildlife law enforcement, and forestry. Northland Community and Technical College, with campuses in East Grand Forks and Thief River Falls, serves approximately 5,600 students, led by Ann Tempty. And Northland will be offering an unmanned aircraft systems maintenance program to meet the growing need for the unmanned aerial vehicles in both military and civilian sectors. Northwest Technical College in Bemidji serves approximately 2,400 students, led by Richard Hansen. And Northwest Tech and 13 area high schools have formed an interesting consortium to strengthen career and technical education beginning in the ninth grade and leading to industry-recognized certificates, associate or bachelor's degrees. Pine Technical College in Pine City, led by Robert Musgrove, serves approximately 1,200 students. And the Johnson Center at Pine Tech offers virtual reality simulator training in their welding and spray painting programs. Quality assurance is an important part of that curriculum. Ridgewater College, with campuses in Hutchinson and Wilmer, serves almost 5,800 students, led by President Doug Allen. Ridgewater recently rolled out a high-tech mobile medical training facility to serve medical clinics and hospitals across the state of Minnesota. Riverland Community College in Albert Lee, Austin, and Owatonna, led by Terrence Lee, serves nearly 4,800 students. The Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation named Riverland Community College as the 2010 Partner of the Year for capitalizing on the assets of new immigrants and minority populations to help increase community vitality in southern Minnesota. Don Cipolla leads Rochester Community and Technical College, serving over 7,900 students. And the Center for Business and Workforce Education at RCTC designs training programs for both IBM and the Mayo Clinic, among other businesses, agribusinesses, and healthcare organizations. Joyce Helens leads St. Cloud Technical and Community College, serving almost 5,200 students. And cardiovascular technology is a new field of study at St. Cloud Tech. Students prepare to assist cardiologists with diagnostic procedures and interventions such as angioplasty and stent placement. Donovan Schwichtenberg leads St. Paul College, serving 8,700 students. And some of you may know that St. Cloud or St. Paul College was ranked as a top community college in the country by Washington Monthly Magazine, which referred to the college's blending of technical education and liberal arts as Shakespeare with power tools. And South Central College, with campuses in North Mankato and Faribault, led by Keith Stover, serves 5,600 students. And South Central is known for its high-tech manufacturing programs, including computer-integrated machining. And now President Szymanski will introduce you to our universities.
President Szymanski.
Thank you. You may follow along with us on page 34 of Go Places. As you heard earlier, we have seven distinct and outstanding regional universities. They are comprehensive in nature, meaning that they meet accreditation requirements for comprehensive universities through a variety of required baccalaureate and graduate programs in the arts and humanities, social and behavioral sciences, physical sciences, business and teacher education, and most offer traditional residential life experiences. Each state university also has distinguishing undergraduate and graduate programs, and I will be telling you about some of them. In addition to the seven state universities play a strong role in building local and regional economies through applied research. We work with local business and industry on research tied to innovation, product development, and commercialization, which helps create jobs. Let me start with Bemidji State, which is led by President Richard Hansen and has an enrollment of 6,531. Bemidji State offers an applied engineering program designed specifically for individuals who typically possess a two-year technical degree and are interested in advancing their professional careers. Metropolitan State hosts the Center for Women Entrepreneurs and Entrepreneurship Education, which offers cutting-edge education to aspiring and existing business owners. The United States Peace Corps has designated Metropolitan State as a partner for volunteers. The Princeton, moving right along here, Minnesota State University Mankato, with President Richard Davenport, has 17,027 students. The Princeton Review has ranked Minnesota State University Mankato's business programs as among the best in the country for five consecutive years. Forbes magazine also recently ranked the university among the top quartile of America's best colleges. My university, Minnesota State University Moorhead, served 8,930 students, and working with the Greater Fargo-Moorhead Economic Development Corporation and our Tri-College partners, we have developed a concentration in vaccinology to fill a growing need in our regional workforce. At St. Cloud University, President Earl Potter served 21,105 students. Responding to an industry need, St. Cloud University recently started two new graduate programs in medical device regulation and applied clinical research. Southwest Minnesota State University, with President David Danahar, served 7,873 students last year, and with 2,400 food manufacturers in the state, the culinology program at Southwest State provides graduates skilled in food product development. Last but not least, Winona State University, with President Judith Romale, has served 9,549 students last year. Winona State's Composite Materials Engineering Program is the only undergraduate engineering program of its type in the United States. The university's National Child Protection Training Center is the premier trainer of child abuse investigators and prosecutors. Now, I would like to turn it over to Chair Thiss.
Thank you, President Szymanski. I'd like to explain the governance structure of the Board of Trustees. The board has 15 members who are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. Eight members represent the state's congressional districts, and four trustees serve at large. Those trustees, 12 trustees, serve six-year terms. In addition, three students, one from each of the system sectors, technical colleges, community colleges and state universities have full voting rights and serve two-year terms. The trustees hire the chancellor and institutional presidents and have broad policy responsibilities for such things as system strategic planning, academic programs, fiscal management, including a capital budget, personnel, admission requirements, tuition and fees, rules and regulations. Over the years, the board has adopted and modified a strategic plan that has provided invaluable guidance for our presidents of our colleges and universities. A one-page version and summary is in your packet. The focus has remained unchanged to enable the people of Minnesota to succeed by providing the most accessible, highest value education in the nation. The plan has five strategic directions, which include increase access, opportunity, and success, achieve high-quality learning through academic excellence and accountability, enhance the global competitiveness of the state, its regions, and its people, innovate to meet current and future educational needs, and sustain financial viability during changing economic and market conditions. I'm pleased to report that we have made some progress in all five areas. A few examples include, we've moved the needle when it comes to success rate for underrepresented students. In 1 year alone, we made a 2-point increase in the success rate to 73%. That may not sound like much, but that's a substantial gain. When we measure success, we count students who graduated, transferred, or stayed enrolled. This is hard work, and it's very important. Improving the success rate is one of our top strategic goals. We believe this success is due in large part to the additional resources that the legislature gave us a couple of years ago. We are using the money for programs and services that have proven effective. About 128,000 students taking science, technology, engineering, and math, also known as STEM courses, are up from 107,000 5 years ago. The system was so successful, in fact, that we surpassed our 2011 goal for STEM enrollment a year early by 14,000 students. Faculty members continue to be recognized for excellence in teaching. This year, Russ Colson, a geosciences professor at Minnesota State University in Moorhead, became the first professor in the state's history to be named U.S. Master's University Professor of the Year. In 2008, Eugenia Paulus, a chemistry professor at North Hennepin Community College, was the first professor in Minnesota to receive the U.S. Community College Professor of the Year. Minnesota State University Mankato has been named one of the nation's top producers of Fulbright scholars among master's degree institutions. Over the last 30 years, the university and faculty and staff members have received 37 Fulbright awards. And six of our community colleges were ranked in the top 50 community colleges in the nation by Washington Monthly Magazine. That magazine is in your packet. Page 48 lists all the schools. Just to name off the six, Vermilion Community College, Minnesota State Community and Technical College at Fergus Falls, Minnesota West in Pipestone, Alexandria Technical College, Itasca Community College, Grand Rapids, and the number one school ranked, St. Paul College. Our colleges and universities continue to innovate. One example, as Kevin mentioned, is Northland Community and Technical College, which is helping to create a new industry by training technicians who can be certified in unmanned aviation aircraft. We also have four centers of excellence in manufacturing and engineering, healthcare, and information technology. Each is led by a state university and has two-year college partners. The lead institutions are Bemidji State University, Winona State University, and Minnesota State University, Mankato, and Metropolitan State University. Altogether, these centers involve 21 system institutions. They work with related industries and organizations to make sure we are teaching the skills and knowledge that workers need by curriculum development. These are just a few examples of our system's success. I'm going to turn it back to the Chancellor, who will wrap up our presentation. But before I do, I want to take a moment to acknowledge Chancellor McCormick, who will be completing 10 productive years as Chancellor when his term ends this summer. When he arrived, the system was about 5 years old, still very much in development. Under Chancellor McCormick's leadership, the system has matured in many ways. The colleges and universities now collaborate as they never did before the system existed, and each has strengthened ties to its local region. Chancellor McCormick has created a culture of continuous improvement, accountability, and transparency in this large and diverse system. He has served the people of Minnesota well. Chancellor?
Thank you very much, Chancellor McCormick, for your kind words. I would like to acknowledge Trustee Krippi, who joined us, and President Doug Allen. We will be back, I'm sure, to talk with you later in the session about budget and the financial challenges. In recent years, we can talk more about this perhaps later, we have had large enrollment growth and shortfalls in funding. We look forward to working with each of you and the committee as you take on this daunting task that we all face this year. And we want to continue, though, very powerfully to have this system contribute to the strong economy and the need for jobs and economic vitality here in Minnesota. Making many visits to every one of the campuses. I'm really very proud of our 32 colleges and universities. I know that this system would not have been created without great support from the legislature. It's had to have governor support too. So I think that as we face these hard times, we have a reason to celebrate the investment that has been made. We've done very well this last 10 years in capital improvements, and I think we need to acknowledge that. I believe these colleges and universities provide immeasurable benefit for the people of Minnesota. I think they contribute greatly to the quality of life we value so much in the state and to the economic vitality of the state. Minnesota has been known as a productive state with a high quality of life for many years. And I believe it is a reputation that we created here, legislators created and others over the years, that we should preserve. I also believe very strongly, and I've had an opportunity to spend time with each of you with one or two exceptions, and I'll close that gap as soon as I can, but I believe that this great state that has so many resources, great farmlands, many things, Fortune 500 companies and so on, but I believe our greatest strength are the people of Minnesota. And this system, along with University of Minnesota and others, contribute greatly to the investment in the most important resource we have, the people of Minnesota. So thank you very much, and that concludes our formal presentation, and now we stand ready to respond to questions.
And we have our first question, Representative Dittmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chancellor, again, thank you for your service to the state of Minnesota, to the Minsky system, and most importantly, to the students of Minnesota. I do have one question. I see we have percentages of students that have gone into different careers. Do you have the numbers of veterans who have come back, are now veterans, have completed their, or are in the process of completing their education? Do you have any figures on that? And maybe you could get that to the chair at a later time.
Yes, I would comment. We'll get you the details, but I want you to know that this system, and it had a lot to do with the Guard leadership, with Larry Schlalto, and the system working together, we are recognized around the country as second to none. We've been recognized by the American Council. I recently was with the American Association of State College and Universities, where this system, is, along with their work, it took two of us together, starting with all of the online learning for our troops in Bosnia. So this is a very important area. Each of the colleges and universities has a veteran center. We make this very important. These are great people coming back that will be so important to the future of Minnesota. And I will have Steve France of our staff get me exact numbers, and we'll send them to the chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chancellor. Representative Morrow, did you have another question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I would echo Representative Detmer's appreciation to you, Chancellor McCormick. I do have two requests for information and a final question. First, on slide number 9, you had the percentages of nurses that you train, firefighters and the like. I know at least at South Central College they've talked about a need to expand the facilities in order to train the future nurses who are calling for the opportunity to even be in the program. If you could report to us, going back to slide number 9 at a later date,
yes,
what are the facilities pressures that prevent you from training, say, the students who would like to become nurses? And there may be other fields as well as where facilities limit your ability to enroll the students who are clamoring for enrollment.
We'll,
Chancellor McCormick,
we know most of that, and we'll get it together and send it to the chair.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, if I may follow up.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned the increase in students in the working in the STEM areas, and there are a number of educators from K-12 and from higher ed around this table. We hear a good deal at times about the need for remedial work when students enter your system. So I'd be interested in hearing more at a later date. What do you see as the preparation level of students entering your system in the STEM fields, given that the K-12 system has, I believe, increased its emphasis of STEM education? So I'd like to know what's going on with remedial work and what's going on in terms of students' preparation for your STEM courses. And again, at a later date, because I don't mean to take the committee's time right now. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I did have a question I said as well as those two requests.
Okay, go ahead, Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor McCormick, I know that you've struggled as a system to control tuition. I believe that you and I were at a meeting earlier this fall in which there was a discussion that the Board of Trustees had talked about a potential tuition increase of up to 5%. I'd like to confirm whether that decision has been made and at what percentage. And then second part of that is my understanding that that 5% does not include the 2% that would be attributable to ERA or federal stimulus money that helped buy down what would have otherwise been a tuition increase. So here's my question. Is it 5%? Is it 7%? Do we know yet about a tuition increase that the wonderful students you described might be facing?
Representative Morrow, the staff,
McCormick,
in conversation, and Mr. Chair, the staff with the board has been modeling with the presidents certain kinds of expectations and changes and so on. But the board has not made a final decision about tuition as of this time.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Morrow. The 5% over the last 2 years with the buy-down of the, is that ERA money? From stimulus money, there was a buy down in tuition, and there was kind of a mythical 5% target that, in essence, tuition went up, although there was a buy down. Because of all the uncertainty and the financial uncertainty and the crosswinds that we're facing, the board has not made any decision on tuition at this time, not knowing exactly where we'd be. We've been working with our student organizations. In fact, I presented and talked with them last week, one of the boards. So we're in constant communication, but no decision's been made.
Thank you. Representative Depke?
Thank you. Commissioner McCormick, it's nice to see you again. I still have a fond memory of our meeting out in my district when I first became elected about 3 years ago, and you came out and gave me a very good overview about the MinSTU system. And I'm sorry now that I'm finally involved in higher ed that you're going to be retiring. So, I do have a question. Many of us yesterday went to a meeting. It was called One Minnesota, which was great. It was held at the Humphrey Institute, and we took a look at some very interesting demographics that are going on in our state, and it has to do with, obviously, with the unemployment figures, but also with adult education opportunities, and with many mid-career people really looking for alternative ways to have careers, in their mid-year, and also to change and have more education. Are you finding at all that any of your increased enrollment, and I heard you say that we had a lot of increased enrollment, is coming from a slightly older population? I see that your average age is 26. Are there any thoughts in the mixed use system to market to or to embrace mid-career professionals that really need to go back and retrain and to get into other areas?
Thank you.
Chancellor McCormick?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to just answer that and then just expand for a moment. Yes, there's an increase in the mid-career people are coming back. But I'd like for just a moment to share a bigger picture. Tony Cavella at Georgetown has been doing scholarly work on the workforce for a number of years. He has just done a recent study where he looked at Minnesota and other places. It is his belief that in order for Minnesota to be globally competitive in the future, that we will need about 70% of our citizens to have some post-secondary. That can be a bachelor's or beyond, it can be a two-year degree, or it can be a certificate program, but a good quality program in order to have the workforce. Now, we're at about 43% now. So to get from 43 by 2018 and where we are now, we've got to do multiple things. The first thing, and this was alluded to in an earlier question, we've got to improve the pipeline. Those individuals coming through high school, we've got to do better. We've got to work with the high school. We've got to get more people graduated and more people through. But even if you improve that significantly, you can't get there from here. We have 2.5 million workers in Minnesota. Some of them have some college credit. We need to circle back and find out who they are, pull them back in to finishing their degrees. And it'll be, and we'll need to have the employers cooperating and supporting. So to get this workforce up where we need it to be globally competitive, we've got to do all things, but that's including the mid-level workers, people coming back, ready for advancement. We need to do all of that in the next few years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. What you said sounds very good to me. This ties in perfectly with what we heard yesterday, and so we'll, believe me, my radar screen will be up on that one.
Representative Roccavini, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first of all, just to Trustee Thies, because, I don't know what the term mythical bindle means, but if I recall correctly, we did use a significant portion of the stimulus money to hold tuition costs down, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, if staff can help me out, we can put something in law, and then put something also in law about not counting the base. If I'm not mistaken, I remember getting called to, because I was coming back here, I got called to the woodshed by Governor Pawlenty to make sure that tuition costs were held down with the stimulus money. So, Morrow asks a very important question. Of course, we're hearing rumors about 5%, and then that didn't include the buy-down of the stimulus package. So I guess I'm confused about what a mythical buy-down is.
Mr. Chair?
Trustee Thies?
Yes, Representative Roccavini. I didn't mean the buy-down was mythical. I said we had kind of an assumed tuition increase, and then it was, in fact, bought down. But there was kind of a rate that it was bought down from, so that's all I was trying to imply. The buy-down was certainly not mythical.
But I recall the Mr. Chair in committee, you may have
Representative Roccavini.
The discussion with Ms. King about what we would the numbers we would use for the buy-down. So, I guess I hope that what we did agree
Representative,
on initially.
Representative Roccavini, I think Mr. Berg might have something to contribute to this discussion.
I appreciate Mr. Berg.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Roccavini and members, just to clarify the issue of the 2%, we did in law last year take federal stimulus dollars, ARRA dollars, and use that to buy off 2 percentage points of the increase at the Minsky schools. That is cooked into the rate, that 2% increase. So that number with the 2% the students didn't pay is the starting point from which the Board of Trustees will then make a decision about tuition next fall. So whatever number they pick, be it 5 or some other number, it's that amount plus 2% that was bought off that the student, a returning student, will see.
Mr. Representative Rukavina.
And Chancellor, I want to congratulate you, too. You've done a very great job in the time you've been here. You're really a nice guy, and we've had our discussions. But we're a state that's really had a significant change. The chairs of higher education in the House of Senate have changed. We have our university president leaving, and you're going to be leaving. And so I'm wondering how the board's doing with its picks to replace you, because, when they replace me, they could probably get some old guy or old lady from the nursing home. But you, on the other hand, we got to find somebody to take your job. So how's that going?
You have a comment on that, Mr. Thiss?
Chair, Representative Rukavina. We are in the process. We have had a search advisory committee that has met, made up of public members. They have recommended some candidates forward. We are in kind of the private informational swapping, recruiting. Are you interested in us? Are we interested in you? In-depth reference checking. We have a target date of, I believe it's Wednesday, February 2nd, that the Board of Trustees would meet to make a final decision. Candidates have not become public yet, and when they become public, we will have the public discussions.
And,
Representative Rukavina.
Chair, Trustee, when do you expect that? Do you have any idea on the timeline on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, we're going to be meeting this week. It will be certainly before our February 2nd date, when we have to announce that when we plan to meet, and there will be an advance for everyone to have some introduction to the candidates, and then we will have open all kinds of open meetings before the board actually meets to make its deliberations.
And finally, then, Mr. Chair, if
Senator Rukavina,
included in that big change in this state has been we got a new governor, and that new governor has absolutely no input on this Board of Trustees. And so what kind of input will the board be asking for or be giving to our new governor, who has right now no say, really, in what's going on as far as the chancellor goes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, I guess I would answer that we hadn't really discussed that. It's worthy of discussion. We had very broad representation on our committee, selection, members of the community from various demographic groups, political groups. Hopefully they came forward with the selection of the best candidates that they had recommended forward.
So,
Representative Rukavina, are you still?
The answer is not.
The answer is I hadn't thought about it to this point. I will consider it.
If I can, just on that same note, are you able to say how many applications you've had to deal with?
I'm advised at this point, because of the situation, we have multiple candidates. I would prefer, Mr. Chair, not to discuss that at this time.
That's fine. I remember being elected to the school board, and we had 80 applicants the first meeting we had. So, to get a new superintendent, so Representative McCormick.
Yeah,
Chancellor.
I don't have any.
You may run for office someday.
No election.
When you have time.
And, but I want to say, Mr. Chair, that the board has been very clear with me that they're expecting me to serve until July 30, and they have an expectation that all of the cuts, all of the adjustments, things that have to be done will be done, and so that we're going to do our very best to create a situation where the new chancellor can start off without having to make the cuts and the other things that have to be done. We hope the cuts will be minimal, but we know it could be a tough session.
Any other members have questions of our distinguished panel? Representative Poppy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chancellor and others, it's always good to see higher ed people come to the table and be able to talk about the good things that are being done in Minnesota. And certainly you have been working hard to help Minnesota work and to educate our students, and so that's very much appreciated. I just had a couple of questions. It kind of goes back to the tuition increases. I do work at a community college, and I certainly am well aware of the amount of money that students need to come up with in order to be able to pursue whatever higher education goal they might have, if it's a career technical field or if it's a doctoral degree, that they need to be able to pay for that. And I'm increasingly concerned about the debt level that our students are incurring, because it is becoming more and more unmanageable, I believe, into the future. And I appreciate that you have a great number of students that are coming through the pipeline and that are getting educated, but those, and so it seems kind of like it doesn't always make sense. There are more students coming in, but they're going to be carrying a greater debt. But I also am concerned about a future that might be a cuts-only scenario when it comes to a budget, that when you have a cuts-only scenario, you're going to try to maybe come up with a way to be able to allow these students to be able to pay for what currently exists, and that is to increase the tuition. So I guess I have a concern about that, and maybe my question is, what would be your debt ceiling? What would you say is the highest that you're looking at for a tuition increase for students? But also, what are the most dramatic things that you're looking at in reducing the costs? And again, with keeping in mind that students are the people that are the consumers, the customers of the system, they're the ones that are paying the bills for the most part. What are the kinds of things that you or the board is looking at changing and doing that is going to, and in the most dramatic fashion, what are the things that you're looking at?
Well, Chancellor McCormick.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppe, I am right with you in the deep concern about student debt. It is going up. It has gone up quite a bit. Many of these older students have jobs and they have families. So this is a real challenge. They're going part-time to pay the tuition. It is a real challenge. All of us that we know about the two-year colleges see that, and that's going on at the universities too. And the debt level, and we have details on this, and we can provide them, Mr. Chair, but it has gone up considerably over time. But the big picture that maybe would be worth just laying on the line then talking about more maybe at the budget hearing. The system has done, I think, remarkably well, the universities and the colleges, in keeping the costs in line with inflation. If you look back over 10 years, the costs of educating a student have remained about the same. And of course, you have more students, so that helps that number. But what has gone on in Minnesota in these last few years is a shift from state support that historically was around 67% to somewhere in the 40s or high 30s. And as that shift over 10 years occurred, we increased the tuition to make up for the shift. And so it's quite a story of I hear people saying, costs are out of control, something has to be done. Our costs are not out of control. And I give the union leadership and others a great deal of credit on this. We've held the costs, bigger classes, other things, made some cuts in the central office, 40 people. We're doing a number of things along the way to keep the cost, but that shift has gone on. The more we do the shift, the bigger it is in terms of tuition to hold the line, and the bigger debt that students have. Now, is this a good idea or a bad idea? I'd like to say it's not good for the future of Minnesota for this reason. We need our graduates to be able to get out, get jobs, move ahead. We need people to take jobs sometimes that aren't the highest paid jobs because the state, the community needs them. And as that debt level gets bigger, it's harder and harder. And so I'm a great advocate for trying to keep affordable access to these public colleges. Now, we do need to acknowledge that the state, the Office of Higher Education, we do have some programs that are significant, student programs, support programs that help the students that are in the most difficulty, but many of our part-time students don't qualify for that. And so we'll have to continue. One thing I've been committed to my entire time, and the board holds me accountable on, I am not going to have a deficit. So we're going to cut, raise tuition, whatever sum, cut, and to make it come out without a deficit. Because once you start, in my opinion, down the deficit track, and then you're just building the problem on top of the problem. So I'm planning, regardless of how difficult it is, to not have a deficit to make it work. But I am very concerned about the tuition. This board, I want to say on their behalf, they really do feel almost to the person, I think, as far as I'm concerned, everyone, to try to hold the tuition down. So, but there are several sources of financing, and you really hit it. One is the state support. The other is the tuition. The other is the federal programs and the student finance programs to help students. And the other leg, the stool, is what can you cut to become more efficient to make this come out? I believe our universities and colleges, perhaps at your later meeting, could give great discussions about what they've done in eliminating some courses that didn't have large enrollments. Every one of the presidents, we are in conversation with them. And I don't want to get off track, but Edna could tell her story, and so could Kevin. So we have these stories about what has been done in order to make it work, and it could be campus by campus. If at some later time, that would be useful. I'm trying not to go too long here, Mr. Chair.
That's right. We do have some time, but we do have a couple of questions, too. So, Representative Morrow?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to follow up on Representative Poppy's question. And Chancellor and Presidents and others in the room, I do respect the challenges you're facing. I really do. This is not meant to offer a critique of you personally. And I agree with you, Chancellor. I think I wrote down the words, it's not good for the future of Minnesota. And I agree with you. And I think you're referring specifically to the debt. First of all, I want to clarify one thing, Mr. Chair, if I might. Am I correct that statutorily you can't carry a deficit? That's a question.
Someone coming.
I appreciate your commitment to not having one, but I want to be really clear. Under law, you can't have a deficit anyway, so I just want to make sure if I'm right about that.
But each institution does not.
We'll give you an answer here soon. Welcome, and identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Laura King, and I'm the Vice Chancellor and Chief Financial Officer for the system. Welcome to the new members. Looking forward to getting to know you. The Chancellor's reference was to the management strategy that he's employed that holds each president at the presidential level responsible for a balanced budget. So we produce profit and loss statements and balance sheets for each of the institutions, and we manage at that level. You're absolutely right. When we consolidate it all up to the system level, the sum of all the parts cannot be negative. But he has pushed that down to the institutional level as well.
Is it on this subject?
Oh, yes.
Oh, okay. Then go ahead, Representative Pulaski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as long as we have our fiscal expert up here, could you explain to the committee the size of the reserves in the Minsky system and break it down by campus?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, we have about $80 million in total in reserves held at each of the colleges and universities. I can get you the list by school if you'd like. That represents about 6% of our total revenue and is a number that our auditors tell us consistently is on the low end of security.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Pulaski.
Vice Chancellor King, we've heard a lot today about your concern about tuition, about debt, about these campuses, and yet you're sitting on incredibly large reserves. In fact, you're sitting on a much larger reserve than the state of Minnesota. So at what point is it critical enough that these reserves be used to offset either the student debt, the tuition, or to preserve critical program? Can you explain that?
Certainly, Mr. Chair and Representative Pulaski. The board's policy around reserves, and it's a standard business practice policy, is that they're for one-time emergency or unexpected events, and buying down tuition would create a continuing ongoing cost. We use those funds for new program development, for one-time equipment purchases. If we have a roof that blows off, we use those funds to fix the roof. But they're really no good to us. Minnesota's facing the same problem. Minnesota's reserves have been drawn down. They've got continuing ongoing problems, and the reserves are gone. And that's a situation we don't want to find ourselves in.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pulaski.
Vice Chancellor King, I've heard over the last few years the comparisons when you had to give bonuses, you used the business example, and now with your reserves you've used the business example. Can you explain which business that is? Is it Wall Street? Is it real estate? Is it banking? Is it the automotive? Which of the business examples that brought this country to its knees are you using in protecting these reserves?
Mr. Chair and Trustee Pulaski, I have in my folder the letter I just got from Standard & Poor's, which is rating our upcoming revenue bond sale. And that was my most recent reference to their standards of care that they look to us for in order to get a rating that's high enough to bring the interest cost to students down. So that's one really good reference point for us. Another is the higher education accrediting agencies. They all look at reserves. They all want to make sure that the president or the chancellor is managing a going operation, that they're exercising care, and that the institution will continue into the future. So there's lots of higher ed sector specific examples around reserves.
So, Mr.
Representative Pulaski
and Vice Chancellor King, was this the explanation then for giving the bonuses, for the chancellor getting $35,000 a year ago and $40,000 this year? What was the explanation for the size of those bonuses, given the economic plight that we're in?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I don't get the connection between reserves and the board's compensation policy.
Well, Mr. Chair, Vice Chancellor King, we have no reserves here at the state level. We are in the largest fiscal crisis since the Depression. We're looking for every possible way that we can do exactly what you said here, ease student debt, lower tuition, or keep it at a level where we can have anyone go to these schools, and yet the reward for what I would call incredible increases in tuition, incredible increases in student debt, was to give incredible bonuses to the chancellor and to the presidents of your institutions. So I'd like an explanation.
Mr. Chair, Trustee Pulaski, in the context of our earlier discussion, those payments were one-time payments. They did not create ongoing costs, and the board and the chancellor will have a new decision to make a year from now based on resources and overall strategy.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chancellor King, I'm sure to the students and public that are listening, a $35,000 bonus on top of a $360,000 salary or a $40,000 bonus is literally equal to somebody's job. And I would hope that the focus, if you're truly concerned about the student and about Minnesota and about jobs, that money could have been put toward a job instead of toward a bonus on top of a salary that is, by any estimation, astronomical.
Representative Pulaski, I think we can maybe save this for another more in-depth discussion on another day.
Mr.
That's
Chair,
okay with
I
you.
Planned to. I thought we were going to be focused like a laser on the budget, and that's what I'm doing.
Oh, you're focused, that's for sure.
All right.
Thank you. Thanks for your questions. And I do have some other people lined up here. We need to get to those. Representative Banyan.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, let me join the chorus in thanking Chancellor McCormick for 10 years of stable and able service to the system. I would also point out that we've had able and stable performance from many of our presidents, and no small part from our ability to attract good ones, which sometimes requires salaries that meet the market, and that sometimes includes a bonus. Wasn't nature of the question I was going to ask, but I thought I'd make note of that. I really wanted to ask something related to where I thought Representative Detke was going. I thought you were going to ask my question, and you went in a different way. So let me put it to you differently. As I think of the threats on the horizon for the system, one of the things that I think about is the demographic changes that we face. Those were the ones that you were talking about at the One Minnesota conference yesterday. And one of those, of course, is declining population, the fact we've had a surge in high school graduations that's not likely to continue. Another one being the changing of the nature of where the population of Minnesota is living is. They stopped by My St. Cloud on their way on down to the Twin Cities. That is changing as well. Can you talk a little bit about where you see the system going in terms of meeting those types of demographic changes? And maybe within that, talk about how you're going to reach what looks to be an older student population than you have historically. Thank you.
Chancellor?
I referenced before what I believe, and statistics back up, will be the need for an educated workforce 2018 and beyond. And given the high school graduation rates, that particularly in greater Minnesota are down, not all areas, some areas are growing, some regional centers, it means that you're going to have to get more people through high school successfully and ready for college if you're going to hit the 70%. But as I said before, we have 2.5 million people that are in the workforce, and I think our colleges and universities are particularly well situated to work with industry and others to provide the kind of continuing education that keeps those workers current and really even adds the degree. So what it really means is all of the people we have, and there's not huge immigration in, there's some, but all the people we have are what we have for the workforce. So we're going to have them better prepared, and I believe this system with 63% will be the major institution that will have to do this. And I think the colleges and universities are quite adaptable to serving the needs of different students. In fact, there's some of my instructor colleagues that say it really benefits the classroom situation to have some older students in there. It brings some experience and it brings some other things. So I think we're well prepared. Also, our online learning makes it possible for older students who have busy schedules to be able to put together a degree program. As many of you know, I think up in the cities we have some students that are putting together a program where they're taking courses at three different institutions at the same time. And our Student First initiative is going to help put all of that together so that some of these courses can be taken at convenient times while they're working. The one thing I don't think we do as well as we need to do at any of our institutions, we need to be a little bit more adaptable toward offering our programs at the time when people can take them, weekends, evenings, putting together maybe a program for 3 weeks that somebody can stay. And I don't think everybody's going to be able to take semesters and years. So we're going to have to adapt too. And frankly, the for-profit colleges are doing that pretty well, and I think they are will be a good competitor, so it makes us change and do better. But we can't do it the same way because our workforce will not be in the same degree those students that are full-time, 15 hours a semester, 4 years. It's a different population. And this public system has and will have to adapt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Benson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I got a comment, I guess, before the question. And the comment is, my understanding is that the executives that receive, quote, the bonus, they're not actually bonuses, but they're part of a pay-for-performance structure. And if the metrics are not met or their goals are not met, that's their total compensation package. Then they don't receive a portion of what is delineated as pay-for-performance. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. My question is, I sat on another committee, healthcare policy, and I'm wondering if one of the largest portions of the pressures, upward pressures on costs, has to do with healthcare costs for employees. If you could comment on that.
Chancellor McCormick.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask my Vice President for Human Resources to come down, but the answer is that is expensive. And that is a concern, and we'll give you a little more detail on that. This is Lori Lamb, who is our Vice Chancellor for Human Resources.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, Representative, a large portion of our costs of employees is not just salaries, but we use a number of about 32% is what the fringe benefit cost is, and a large part of that is related to health insurance. As a system, we participate in the state employee group insurance program with every other state agency, so the costs are the same. And as you all know, that's a self-insured plan. And in the last couple of years, the increases in the insurance costs have driven a lot of the costs of personnel costs for all agencies up. And so we continue to look forward to that, and we're all expecting quite a cliff in those costs coming up in the range of potentially about 13% increases in the next couple of years.
Thank you. Thank you.
Follow up. Okay. Representative Morrill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And certainly, I know Representative Benson, we don't want to start the health care debate in this committee as well. And I'm sorry that Representative Bannion stepped out, because I was going to reference him in this. Chancellor, again, I appreciate that your heart's in the right place. You're trying to do the right thing. At the same time, I'm going to caution against the phrase, we're going to be more efficient. Because I will tell you, as a professor, and maybe Representative Benson has shared this experience and Representative Bannion, what more efficient can also mean is students have a hard time getting the classes they need because classes have been cut. I know at MSU Mankato, I believe it's 18 teaching lines, I may be using the wrong phrase, have been eliminated. That could be called efficiency, or that could be called 5 years to graduate because I couldn't get the course I needed. So I would like to hear from the system at a later date. As cuts go forward, what do you foresee to be the impact upon students being able to enter and being able to complete their desired degree on time? Because we all know a fifth year means a fifth year of expense as well. And I know you understand that, but I would like to hear more about that because we should understand what efficiency means. Efficiency means elimination of programs, departments, and courses.
We welcome that opportunity to share that with you. And I might say we've made lots of cuts already, and it's getting a lot harder and still preserve the quality. Thank you.
Okay, I just had one McCormick story I wanted to share, if you stay around for 1 minute. I want to thank him for the years of service, and he's coming back. This is not his last farewell address, but several years ago I got a call. As you know, he likes to come around and meet each one of you and get to know you. And several years ago I got that call, and he said, I'm coming up to Fergus Falls, and will you be home? And I said, no. I had planned to take my grandkids on a camping trip, and I expected to find another date, and instead Chancellor McCormick said, well, how do I get there? And he came and joined us at our campsite for coffee and muffins. So I thought that's above and beyond the call of duty, but much appreciated, and I might have 3 grandkids who live in Chicago coming to school in Minnesota someday because of that.
Good.
So appreciate that. So I just want to share that. No? It was 8:30 in the morning, much too early for a campfire.
Could have got it with his pony.
Any further comments? If not, next meeting will be next Tuesday. We'll continue our overviews at that time, and we'll hear from the Office of Higher Education. So with that, we are adjourned.